When the lights go out, they speak. The vanished, the cursed, the cruel. Their echoes live here. I'm Raven Vale, and you've just crossed the threshold. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Welcome to Whispers from the Dark. Tonight's episode: The Door That Didn't Exist. The Disappearance of Brian Schaffer. There is something particular about surveillance footage. It has an authority that other forms of evidence don't carry in quite the same way. A witness can be wrong. A memory can distort. A statement can be incomplete or contradicted or colored by the particular emotional state in which it was given. These are the ordinary vulnerabilities of human testimony, and they are well understood by anyone who has spent time in investigative or legal contexts. But footage has a different quality. It records without interpretation, without agenda, without the filtering that every human observer applies, consciously or not, to what they see. When a camera captures something, the assumption is that what you see is what happened. No more, no less. Exactly that. This is not perfectly true, of course. Cameras have angles. They have blind spots. They have limitations of resolution and coverage area that mean even well-documented spaces contain gaps. But within their documented range, they provide a record that carries a different evidentiary weight than almost anything else available to investigators. And when a camera captures a man walking through a door and then shows no record of him ever walking back out, when every other person who entered that building can be accounted for, their exit recorded, their departure confirmed, the footage doesn't just document a mystery, it creates one. It establishes, with the specific authority of recorded evidence, that something happened here that cannot be explained by any sequence of events that leaves the visible world intact. We have the before. We do not have the after. And the gap between those two things has held people's attention for nearly 20 years. On the night of April 1st, 2006, in Columbus, Ohio, a 27-year-old medical student named Brian Schaffer went out with friends. It was the last weekend before spring classes resumed at Ohio State University, where Brian was studying to become a doctor. He had grown up in Pickerington, Ohio, a suburb southeast of Columbus. He was the kind of person described consistently by every account available in the particular terms people use for someone who seemed to be doing everything right. Smart, focused, personable. Genuinely liked. He had been at Ohio State long enough to have built the kind of social world that college and graduate programs produce at their best. A network of people who knew him across different contexts, who had shared meals and late study sessions and ordinary accumulated time with him. He had a girlfriend named Alexis Wagoner, also a medical student, who was out with him that night. He had a father named Rich Schaffer, who thought the world of him. He had a future that looked, from the outside, like a thing in good order. He also had something he was carrying that spring that not everyone knew the weight of. 2 weeks before he disappeared, his mother, Renee, had died of a rare blood disorder called Erdheim-Chester disease. She had been sick for some time. The family had known the illness was serious. But knowing something is coming and experiencing its arrival are different things, and the gap between them is where grief actually lives. Brian had been close to his mother, The loss was recent. 2 weeks recent, which is barely any time at all in the scale of a grief that will take years to become something livable. And Brian was in the middle of a demanding program, surrounded by the expectations that medical school generates in the people moving through it. There is a particular difficulty in grieving inside an environment that requires continuous performance of competence, where falling apart, if it happens, tends to happen in private, where the signal sent to the world is fine, managing, moving forward, because the alternative is a disruption to a path that has been built over years and cannot easily be paused. Whether Brian was struggling in ways that were visible to the people around him is something the people around him have answered differently. Alexis and his friends described him that night as normal, present himself, not visibly distressed, not someone who seemed to be approaching a breaking point. Whether that is the full picture or the picture that was presented to them, the one Brian chose to show is something only Brian could have answered. That context does not explain what happened to him, but it is part of the picture of who Brian Schaffer was on the night of April 1st, 2006, and it is worth holding alongside everything else as the story unfolds. The night began on the short North Strip, a stretch of Columbus known for its bars and restaurants that fills up on weekends with students, young professionals, and anyone else drawn to the particular energy of a place where a lot of people decide to be in the same general area on the same evening. Brian was with Alexis and a group of friends. They had been to several locations earlier in the evening. At some point, the group became less cohesive, as groups on late nights out tend to do. People split off. People moved between venues. The organized beginning of the evening dissolved into the more fluid middle of it, where individual decisions start to diverge from the group's original plan. By the time they arrived at the Ugly Tuna Saluna, it was late, close to 2 in the morning. The Ugly Tuna was a popular bar spread across multiple levels, situated in a building on High Street that, at the time, was also undergoing renovation on certain floors. There was construction. There were areas of the building in various states of partial completion. There were, as a consequence of this, more ways in and out of the building than a standard establishment might have, though exactly how many and exactly which ones were accessible to patrons would become a central question in the investigation that followed. Outside the main entrance of the Ugly Tuna, a security camera was positioned to record the flow of people coming and going. It was the kind of setup common to bars on busy weekend nights. A record of who was there, a deterrent against certain behaviors, a basic layer of documentation that no one expects to become the central artifact of a criminal investigation. The camera was not high definition by modern standards. The footage it produced was the footage of its era, serviceable, identifiable, but not the crisp resolution that would allow for the kind of analysis that has since been brought to bear on it. At approximately 1:55 in the morning, that camera captured Brian Schaffer approaching the entrance. He paused briefly. He spoke to 2 women near the door, women who were later identified and interviewed, and who confirmed the brief exchange was casual and unremarkable. A few words, a smile, the ordinary micro-interaction of someone in a sociable state on a late night out. Brian didn't appear agitated. He did not appear to be in any kind of distress. He appeared, in the footage that shows him for the last time, like a person at the end of a normal night, doing what people do at the end of normal nights. He was present. He was himself. And then he walked through the door. That is the last confirmed visual record of Brian Schaffer that exists. Not the last moment of his life, necessarily, but the last moment in which the documentary record places him somewhere, doing something, alive and present in the visible world. After that frame, after that threshold, there is nothing. Alexis left the bar later that night. She and Brian had been separated at some point in the crowd, the way people are in busy venues late on weekend nights. She had assumed at some point that Brian had simply gone home, or that they'd simply lost track of each other in the noise and press of a crowded bar at closing time. She tried to reach him. He didn't respond. By the following day, the silence was no longer easily explained by the ordinary possibilities. Brian did not show up where he was expected. His calls went unanswered. His apartment showed no sign of his return. His father, Rich, was contacted. And what began as concern escalated, with the specific acceleration that happens when the first few ordinary explanations run out and the remaining ones are not ordinary at all. Police were brought in. The footage from the Ugly Tuna was reviewed, and the review produced a finding that the investigators and everyone who has examined this case since have struggled to accommodate within a conventional framework. Brian Schaffer walked in. He did not walk out. Every other person who entered the Ugly Tuna that night, every patron, every person who came and went in the hours the bar was open, could be identified on the footage exiting the building. Everyone except Brian. He was not on the footage leaving through the front entrance. He was not captured on any other camera in the area that night. He was not seen by any staff member departing. He was not witnessed by any patron remembering someone leaving in a condition that would have stood out. He was simply not there. And then, on the footage, he was not anywhere. The investigation that followed Brian Schaffer's disappearance was extensive by the standards of a missing persons case. Columbus police reviewed the footage repeatedly and in detail. They interviewed staff. They interviewed patrons who could be identified and located. They canvassed the area. They examined the building itself, the multiple floors of the Ugly Tuna, the areas under renovation, the back sections and service areas that were not standard patron spaces. They worked the case in the days following with the urgency that a recent disappearance demands before the trail goes cold, before memories fade, before the physical evidence of an event begins to deteriorate into something less recoverable. And what they found, or more precisely, what they did not find, has defined the case ever since. No evidence of a struggle inside the bar. No blood. No indication of any disturbance that patrons or staff recalled. No one who remembered seeing Brian after he entered, either in a state of distress or leaving under his own power. The bar's staff had no specific memory of him. In a crowded late-night bar on a busy weekend, that is not unusual. Bartenders and floor staff in high-volume venues see hundreds of faces across a single shift. Individual customers rarely register unless something draws attention. Brian, by all indications, drew no attention, which means either that he was present and unremarkable, blending into the crowd without incident, or that he exited through a part of the building where staff were not stationed and therefore had no opportunity to observe him. The question that immediately presents itself, the one that investigators and everyone who has studied this case since have returned to repeatedly, is whether there was an exit from the Ugly Tuna building that the primary security camera didn't cover. The answer to this question is, almost certainly, yes. The Ugly Tuna occupied a building that was, at the time, partially under construction. Buildings under renovation have service entrances. They have contractor access points. They have areas where the ordinary flow of traffic does not apply, where a door that should be locked might not be, where a passage that doesn't appear on a standard floor plan might exist in the reality of a partially finished space. Investigators explored this. They mapped the building as best they could. They identified potential exit points that were not covered by the primary camera. And their conclusion was that it was possible, structurally possible, for a person to have left the ugly tuna building that night through a route that would not have been recorded. Possible, but unconfirmed, because the possible route explains how Brian could have left without appearing on camera. It does not explain what happened to him after he left. It does not account for the complete absence of any subsequent confirmed sighting. It does not close the case. It only opens the next question. The possibility that Brian exited through an unconventional path, a construction area, a service access, a part of the building that bypassed the main entrance, is the most structurally sound explanation available for how he could have left the building without appearing on the footage. It is also an explanation that generates its own set of questions. Because if Brian exited through an unconventional path, that exit was either deliberate or accidental. Either Brian knew about the alternative exit and chose it, or he found himself in a part of the building he hadn't intended to be in, and left through whatever opening was available. And whatever happened to Brian after he left the building through that route happened entirely outside the documented record. There are no cameras that captured him on the streets of Columbus in the hours after his disappearance. There are no confirmed sightings. There are no witnesses who came forward with a clear, credible account of seeing Brian Schaffer after approximately 2 in the morning on April 2, 2006. He stepped out of the frame and did not step back into it. Here is where the investigation branches in ways that have never fully converged on a single explanation. The first branch is voluntary disappearance. The theory that Brian, for reasons known only to himself, chose to walk away. He had been dealing with the recent death of his mother. A death that was only 2 weeks old when he went out that April night. 2 weeks is no time at all to process the loss of a parent. It is barely enough time to begin to register the permanence of the absence. And Brian had been in the middle of a demanding medical school program, surrounded by peers who expected competence and composure, navigating an environment that does not create much space for the full weight of grief to be expressed or acknowledged. He was under the stresses of medical school, which are considerable and not always visible to the people around the person carrying them. He was, by the accounts of those who knew him, someone who internalized rather than expressed. Not cold, not closed. Just the kind of person who tends to carry things quietly rather than laying them down in front of others. People who disappear voluntarily, who make a conscious decision to step out of their lives, are rarely the people who announced their distress most loudly beforehand. They are often the people who seemed fine, who seemed to be managing, who seemed, from the outside, like people with a future clearly in front of them, and every reason to continue walking toward it. The voluntary disappearance theory does not require Brian to have been in extreme, visible crisis. It requires only that something that night, something inside him, something in the bar, something accumulated over the weeks since his mother died, and perhaps long before that, reached a threshold of its own. A point where leaving felt not like a choice, among several options, but like the only available response to something he was experiencing that nobody around him could see. This theory has always troubled the people who knew Brian most. His father, Rich, could not reconcile it with the person he knew. Alexis could not place it alongside the Brian she had been with earlier that evening, who had seemed like himself, who had seemed present, who had given no indication of an intention to vanish. But the people who know someone best are also often the people most unable to see the specific dimension of that person that remained hidden. Not through any failure of love or attention. Simply because certain things are kept precisely from the people whose reaction would matter most. The second branch is something darker. That Brian encountered something in or near the ugly tuna that he did not survive. A confrontation with someone he knew or someone he didn't. An accident in a part of the building that was not a normal patron space. A fall, a structural hazard, an area of the construction zone that was accessible but dangerous. An encounter with someone who had reason to ensure that Brian's disappearance left no trace. This theory requires a body that was never found. And the absence of remains in a case of this kind is one of the most significant obstacles to resolution. Columbus is not the wilderness. It is a city with infrastructure, proximity, density, and the kind of ongoing institutional attention that makes extended concealment genuinely difficult. But not impossible. The Scioto River runs through Columbus. The city has, like any city, areas of lower visibility, spaces that change over time, construction and demolition cycles that alter what lies beneath the accessible surface. A body disposed of in the right location, in the right conditions, in the hours when the city is least observed, can remain outside the documented record for a very long time. The absence of Brian Schaffer's remains from the spaces that were searched does not mean his remains were never there. It means they were not found where investigators looked. That distinction matters, and it is a distinction that leaves the foul play theory permanently open rather than definitively ruled out. The third branch, the one that generates the most online discussion but the least institutional credibility, involves the suggestion that something occurred that does not fall within ordinary explanatory frameworks, that the disappearance at a threshold, the complete absence from any subsequent documentation, the quality of simply ceasing to be visible in a place where visibility was the norm, points to something that the available categories do not accommodate. This branch does not have evidentiary support. It has only the shape of the event, which is, in its bare facts, genuinely difficult to hold without some response to the strangeness of it. A man walks in. Nobody sees him leave. Nobody finds where he went. That is not a metaphor. That is the documented record of what happened. And the documented record of what happened in this case is strange enough that the impulse to reach for explanations outside ordinary categories is understandable, even if it is not evidentiary. There is one more detail that has never been fully resolved and sits in the middle of the case like a question mark that won't lie flat. Months after Brian disappeared, not days, not weeks, but months, his cell phone registered a ping on a cell tower. A single activation of the network. One signal from a phone that had been silent. Then silence again. Phone signals of this kind do not require the phone's owner to be alive. A phone can be turned on by someone else. A battery can briefly revive in certain conditions. A phone can be found, activated, and discarded again. The ping does not confirm Brian was alive months after he disappeared, but it does confirm that his phone was operational somewhere, at some point, in some context that has never been explained, and unexplained details in a case that has no resolution tend to accumulate into a weight that becomes harder and harder to set down. There is a dimension to the Brian Schaffer case that does not get discussed in proportion to its significance, and that is what happened to his father. Rich Schaffer spent the years following his son's disappearance doing what any parent in that position would do. He searched. He advocated. He kept Brian's name in the public conversation. He pursued every lead he could reach and pushed back against any indication that the case was fading from institutional attention. He gave interviews. He engaged with investigators. He used every platform available to him to keep the question of what happened to his son from being quietly filed away and forgotten in the way that unresolved missing persons cases sometimes are when the news cycle moves on and the urgency of the initial search fades into the quieter persistence of ongoing investigation. He was, by every account, a man transformed by loss into a version of himself defined by the single purpose of finding out what happened to his son. In June of 2008, just over 2 years after Brian disappeared, Rich Schaffer was found dead. He had been missing for a brief period before his body was discovered. The cause of death was determined to be accidental. There was no finding of foul play. Rich had been dealing with significant health issues in the years following Brian's disappearance, and the physical and psychological toll of sustained grief and the relentless advocacy of a parent searching for a missing child is not a thing that leaves the body untouched. The human body was not designed to carry that kind of uncertainty indefinitely. The stress of not knowing, of holding open a wound that has no confirmed source, and therefore no possibility of clean healing, is physiological as much as psychological. And Rich had been carrying it for 2 years when it ended. But the fact of it, the father who lost his son, who spent 2 years looking, who then also died before the answer came, is a layer of tragedy in this case that sits differently from the central mystery. It means the person most motivated to find Brian, the person with the deepest personal knowledge of who Brian was and how he thought and what might have happened to him, is also gone. And the people who remain, Alexis, Brian's broader family, the investigators who have worked the case over the years, are carrying the search without the anchor of Rich's specific knowledge and his specific drive. The case has never been closed. Columbus police have maintained it as an active investigation, though the practical definition of active in a case with no new physical evidence and no confirmed leads is necessarily limited. Over the years, various tips have come in. Reported sightings in different parts of the country. Individuals who believed they recognized Brian in various contexts. None of these have led to a confirmed identification. None have produced the kind of specific, verifiable information that would allow investigators to move from the current state of the case, suspended, unresolved, held open by the absence of a closing fact, to something that could be concluded. The case has attracted the attention of the same online investigative communities that have followed other unresolved disappearances. People who apply significant time and attention to reviewing available information, analyzing the footage frame by frame, constructing precise timelines, identifying minor inconsistencies in the public record, and attempting to surface something in the details of the known record that might suggest a direction that has not been fully explored. As with other cases of this kind, the results of this collective attention are mixed. Some of it reflects genuine analytical care and produces observations that are worth serious consideration. Some of it reflects the tendency of extended, passionate inquiry to generate connections and patterns that the evidence does not actually support. The same human pattern recognition system that serves us so well in other contexts, working overtime on a case that resists resolution and producing structure where the evidence offers none. What the collective attention has not produced, despite nearly two decades of sustained effort, is an answer. The footage from the ugly tuna has been reviewed frame by frame by people with no personal stake and no institutional constraints on their time. And the conclusion they have reached is the same conclusion the original investigators reached. Brian Schaffer is on the footage entering the bar. He is not on the footage leaving. There is no subsequent frame that resolves the question of where he went. Now let's sit with what we actually know. Not what we suspect. Not what the various theories propose. What the documented record, stripped of interpretation, actually contains. Brian Schaffer was last confirmed to be alive at approximately 1:55 a.m. on April 2nd, 2006, outside the Ugly Tuna Saluna on High Street in Columbus, Ohio. He entered the building. He was not recorded exiting through the main entrance. He was not seen by any witness after that point in any confirmed, credible, verifiable account. His phone registered one network ping months later. His remains have never been found. His case has never been officially closed. His father died without knowing what happened to him. That is the entirety of what can be stated as confirmed fact. Everything else, every theory, every proposed explanation, every framework applied to make sense of the event, is inference built on that foundation. And the foundation is, in its bare facts, genuinely strange. Not because disappearances don't happen. They happen. Not because people don't vanish from urban environments without leaving immediately discoverable traces. That happens too. Not even because the footage creates an impossible situation, because it does not, strictly speaking, create an impossibility. It creates a specific kind of documented absence. A record of the moment before, with no corresponding record of the moment after. And it is that specific quality, not the impossibility of it, but the visibility of the threshold, that distinguishes this case from others. Most disappearances have the quality of an unknown. We don't know what happened because we weren't watching. The record simply doesn't exist. The Brian Schaffer case has the quality of a known unknown. We know we were watching. We know what the watching captured. And what the watching captured is, he went in. And after that, nothing. That specificity is what makes the case different from an ordinary absence. It gives the mystery a frame. The footage says, here is the before. The investigation says, there is no after. And in the space between those two statements, a real person, a son, a boyfriend, a medical student who had survived the loss of his mother and was 2 weeks into carrying that grief, simply is not there. Brian Schaffer would be in his mid-40s now. If he is alive somewhere, he has been living outside the documentary record for longer than he lived inside it. He was 27 when he walked through that door. He had a future that everyone who knew him expected to unfold in visible, conventional ways. A medical career, a life with Alexis, a relationship with a father who loved him and spent 2 years searching before he too was gone. None of that happened. Or if it did, it happened somewhere that no confirmed record has located. The ugly Tuna Saluna is gone now. The building on High Street has changed. The specific physical threshold that the camera captured in 2006 no longer exists in the form it existed that night. But the footage does. And the footage still shows the same thing it showed the morning investigators first reviewed it. A man walking toward a door. A man crossing a threshold. And after that, nothing that can be confirmed. Nothing that closes the question. Just the door. This has been Whispers from the Dark. I'm Raven Vale, and some doors don't just lead somewhere else. Some doors don't lead back, and the ones that don't are the ones we can never stop watching.